I've been called a troublemaker, and I wear that label proudly. And tonight I'm going to use some words and employ some ideas that might trouble you. And what I would like for you to do is think about your values that you attach to those ideas and words. So I'm assuming that most of you think that the weekend and vacations are good things. I assume most of you think that dancing or listening to non-classical music is not evil. I'm betting that while you might have some mixed feelings about cosmetics and hairstyles and fashionable clothes, you probably are glad that those things are available to ordinary working class people. If you're a woman, I think there's one here. All right. I'm guessing, but correct me if I'm wrong, that you think it is okay for you to walk in public without a male chaperone, for you to earn high wages, to own property. I would also bet that many of you believe that oral sex, interracial sex, and sex outside of marriage are not wicked. So if any of this is true, I want to introduce you tonight to your cultural ancestors, people you probably are not aware of as being your cultural ancestors. And these are people I think you should also consider to be your heroes. Your cultural ancestors are drunks, prostitutes, lazy workers, and shiftless slaves. These people should be your heroes because they pioneered many of the freedoms and pleasures that you probably could not imagine life without. And the enemies of the freedoms that your ancestors pioneered are probably not the people you think they are either. If you're a conservative, I doubt there's anyone tonight. But if you are one, you'll probably be glad to know that the Founding Fathers, because conservatives tend to revere the Founding Fathers, that they opposed your freedom to have leisure from work. They opposed your freedom to listen to or dance to non-classical music. They opposed your freedom to make yourself look physically attractive with fashionable clothing, makeup, or hairstyles. And they opposed adamantly, consistently, and loudly your freedom to have sex outside of marriage. But if you're a liberal, or if you're someone far to the left of liberal, you might be surprised, and I hope actually that you're a little bit disturbed, to learn that abolitionists and feminists opposed all of those freedoms as well. So now if you know anything about me, you know that one of my very favorite freedoms is the freedom from work. But the belief that leisure is a good thing is relatively new. In fact, very few Americans know that leisure was officially evil until the late 19th century. Now, of course, when the settlers got here, the first white settlers from Europe, when they got here, they were faced with lots and lots of trees and lots of Indians. So that took a lot of work to carve a living out of that wilderness. Certainly. But from the time of the very first settlements to the present day, no people in the world have promoted the work ethic. And what is the work ethic? The work ethic is a belief that work in itself is a good thing, regardless of what you gain from it. No people in the world, from then until now, have promoted the work ethic more strenuously than have Americans. And no people attacked leisure, attacked play, and attacked fun more loudly, more violently than did the so-called free Americans of the New Republic. From the time of the very first Puritan settlements in New England through the Industrial Revolution of the late 19th century, children's books, school primers, newspaper editorials, poems, pamphlets, sermons, and political speeches pummeled Americans with the idea that to work was to be godly and to be idle was to be wicked. Cotton Mather, the very famous Puritan minister, he instructed parents to keep their five-year-old children in what he called continual employment so as to deliver them from the temptations of idleness. And then another Puritan minister, a little bit less well-known but also quite prominent among Puritans, named Thomas Shepard, he told his own son, who I think was 8 years old at the time, to, quote, abhor 1 hour of idleness as you would be ashamed of 1 hour of drunkenness. Then in the 18th century, Benjamin Franklin very famously told Americans to work all hours of the day in order to be virtuous and to be happy. In Poor Richard's Almanac, He wrote, "It is the working man who is the happy man. It is the idle man who is the miserable man." On the very first page of the most commonly used school primer, this is for grade school children, very first page of that textbook for children was this poem. "How doth the little busy bee improve each shining hour and gather honey all the day from every opening flower." It's very sweet, starts off. "In works of labor or of skill, I would be busy too, for Satan finds some mischief still for idle hands to do." American schools later in the early 19th century taught children to avoid what they called the frivolities of play and to make themselves useful through the exercise of self-denial, self-sacrifice, and constant hard work. By far the best-selling primer for school children through the 19th century was Noah Webster's American Spelling Book. Virtually every white school child in the 19th century read this book. It instructed its young readers that, quote, "A wise child loves to learn his books, but the fool would choose to play with toys." Now, these lessons on the work ethic were taken to heart, especially by American farmers, who constituted the great majority of the American population all the way through the 19th century. They were famously devoted to work, both as a necessary means of survival, certainly, but also as a virtue in itself. The work ethic became a central part of formal American culture. But thankfully, very thankfully, there were many children who did not follow these lessons when they grew up to be adults. And there were other children who lived inside the United States, but never lived of the United States, who were never taught these lessons at all. These children grew up to become heroes in my book. They were drunken, lazy workers, and they were slaves who were called shiftless. Most Americans now don't know that in the early American economy of the early 19th century, in the first factories that were produced, that were developed, it was the norm for workers to decide when they showed up to work and when they went home. And that was largely unchallenged by employers. It was the cultural norm, so employers could not challenge it. They simply could not find workers to replace those slacking workers because most workers agreed with that norm. Workers typically spent long periods in the afternoon eating, drinking, and sleeping on the job. And again, those things were taken for granted and largely unchallenged by their bosses. And the three-day weekend in the first factories was the norm. One of the largest and most important early industries in the United States was shoe manufacturing, and cobblers were known to frequently stop work for games, to have long conversations about politics or gossip or whatever, and to shuffle off to the grog shop. Workers in many of the first major industries were normally paid for 6 days of work and formally expected to at least show up for 6 days of work. But on Saturday, on the job, at work, they drank beer all day long. And then the drinking usually continued into Saturday night, and then it usually continued all the way through Sunday. So that by Monday, most workers in the first major industries in the United States were unable or unwilling to work at all. And this gave rise to a wonderful and now forgotten tradition called Blue Monday. It was a worker's day of rest following the Lord's day of rest. The point I'm trying to make here, and I do in the book, is that cultural norms are often, perhaps always, more powerful than laws. So simply by being lazy, these were unorganized workers, these were workers not in trade unions, they did not go on strike, generally. Simply by being lazy, simply by being slackers, these workers established the idea of the weekend. The rejection of industrial discipline and the embrace of leisure is a good thing. Increased, actually, in the late 19th century when workers from pre-modern peasant cultures in southern and eastern Europe flooded the shores. Immigrant workers in New York City shipyards made their bosses very angry by taking long breaks to eat cake, to eat candy, and to take long trips to the saloon for wine and whiskey. Workers in the first pottery factories were known to work in what employer called great bursts of activity and then disappear for several days at a time. The new immigrants also continued the early American tradition of the informal three-day weekend. One employer said that for his immigrant workers, Monday was given up entirely to debauchery. The owner of a cigar factory, cigar manufacturing was another important industry in the early turn-of-the-century economy, he complained that his employees spent far more time slacking than they did working on the job. He said, "The difficulty with many cigar makers is this. They come down to the shop in the morning, they roll a few cigars, and then they go to a beer saloon and play pinochle all day long. They work at most 2 or 3 hours a day." And he could not find replacement workers who were willing to work any harder. They simply did not believe that work was a good thing. None of this should be surprising to anyone who is aware that the Protestant work ethic is not natural. It doesn't grow out of the ground like a tree. And it most certainly was not invented in the peasant societies of Europe, where most of the early American workers came from. And it was especially an alien concept, a really weird concept, in southern and eastern Europe, where most immigrants of the late 19th century came from. All of those workers had to be trained to believe that work, regardless of what you gained from it, was a good thing in itself. They had to be trained to be Americans. The Protestant work ethic most certainly was not invented in West Africa either, and so it should be no surprise at all that slaves rejected it as well. The idea that work was virtuous was an entirely Northern European, American, middle class, and white invention. Many, many visitors came from the North and toured Southern plantations, and they were again and again and again struck by how much less slaves worked than did so-called free laborers. And in fact, economic historians now have determined that on average, slaves worked 400 fewer hours per year than did Northern white free, quote-unquote, farmers. Hundreds of ex-slaves who were interviewed in the 1930s about their experiences as slaves complained that they were actually expected to work much harder as free laborers than they were as slaves. And nearly all of the ex-slaves who were interviewed rejected entirely the concept of work as being godly or virtuous. You probably all love the vacation that we have it, or at least we are supposed to have it. In America, we're having it less and less, I know. The concept of a vacation did not exist in the United States. The idea that you were entitled to a long break from work simply did not exist in the United States until well after the Civil War. Now, slaves did not employ the concept of the vacation. They certainly didn't invent the term, but they sure as hell pioneered the practice. An ex-slave named Lorenzo L. Ivey remembered it this way. He said, "Sometimes slaves just ran away for a week or two to get a rest from the field, and then they came back." Another slave named Sally Smith, this is a very typical statement made by the ex-slaves in the interviews. She said she took frequent breaks from work. She said that all the slaves she worked with did the same thing. And most importantly, unlike free laborers who subscribe to the work ethic, she felt no shame in it at all. She said, "Sometimes I'd go so far away from the plantation I couldn't hear the cows moo or the roosters crow." Now, slave owners called this practice of leaving for periods and then coming back in these unauthorized breaks, they called it truancy. It was rampant on southern plantations, and it was far more common than slaves leaving permanently. It's a common misconception that the Underground Railroad was common. Very small percentage of slaves actually left on the Underground Railroad permanently, but many, possibly most slaves left their plantation for these extended periods, these breaks from work when they felt like it. Virtually all of the plantations whose records are available show that disappearances lasting days, weeks, months, and even years were common. Slaves simply had much, much more power over their masters than we normally think. Historians have found that masters, in fact, were much more likely to let their slaves get away with truancy without punishment than to punish them for it. Often a slave would stay in the woods or on a neighboring plantation or even in a nearby town until he received a promise of amnesty from his master. I won't come back until you promise to not punish me. And more often than not, the amnesty was granted. Some truant slaves actually moved their entire place of residence from their home plantation to another plantation, and then they commuted to work. The number of slaves who took unauthorized breaks, the number of slaves who were truants, was so great that a man named Dr. Samuel Cartwright, who was sort of the South's leading medical authority, he invented a disease, or discovered, he thought, a disease that he called drapetomania, which he said blacks were particularly susceptible to. The major symptom of drapetomania was what he called the absconding from service. Now, of course, white racists thought that this was simply another piece of evidence that blacks were naturally inferior and that they were naturally disinclined to work. Now, that this belief that the reluctance to work was natural or biological or racial was rejected first, and I think most intelligently and most powerfully, by the eminent black social scientist W.E.B. Du Bois, who explained it as the inevitable consequence of forced labor. Du Bois said this. This is my favorite passage in all of his work, and it's in a book that's not very well known. It's called The Gift of Black Folk, Not the Souls of Black Folk. Very few people read this one, but they all should. He said, "All observers spoke of the fact that the slaves were slow and churlish, that they wasted material and malingered at their work. Of course they did. This was not racial, but economic. It was the answer of any group of laborers forced down to the last ditch. They might be made to work continuously, but no power on earth could make them work well." And then Du Bois went even farther in a very stunning passage, and I'll never forget the first time I read this. He argued that all of this might have been evidence of the slaves' superiority over whites, who worked for themselves and believed that working for oneself and that work in itself was a good thing. Du Bois said that the slave, quote, was not as easily reduced to be the mechanical draft horse which the northern European laborer had become. He was not easily brought to recognize any ethical sanctions in work as such, but tended to work as the results pleased him, and he refused to work or sought to refuse when he did not find the spiritual returns to be adequate. Thus, he was easily accused of laziness and driven as a slave, when in truth he brought to modern manual labor a renewed valuation of life. Du Bois was saying to his white racist readers, you're absolutely right. Slaves did not believe that work is better than life, and why on earth do you? So at the very same time that white slackers and shiftless slaves were inventing American leisure, some very bad women were inventing women's liberation. And I'm not talking about feminists. In the 19th century, a woman who owned property, who made high wages, who had sex outside of marriage, who performed or received oral sex, who used birth control, who consorted with men of other races, who danced, who drank, or walked alone in public, who wore makeup, perfume, or stylish clothing, and most importantly, was not ashamed of any of those things, was almost certainly a whore. In fact, prostitutes won virtually all of the freedoms that were denied to women but are now taken for granted. Women who chose prostitution enjoyed a very favorable market for their labor. Demand, of course, was always enormous and constant, and the pool of available labor was kept small by the stigma that was attached to the trade. So even the poorest paid prostitutes, the so-called streetwalkers, these were the women who weren't even attached to brothels, who simply walked the streets by themselves, even those women at the lowest, at the bottom of the trade, earned at least five times what the average woman worker made in a so-called legitimate profession. The United States Department of Labor got very concerned about this, and in 1916 they conducted a study of prostitution, and they found that on average prostitutes earned $40 per week. This is in 1916. How much money was that? It was exactly double what white male trade union construction workers made. The high wages of prostitutes made them not only the wealthiest women in the United States, it also made them the only economically independent women in the country. Prostitutes were the first women in this country to break free of what early American feminists, I think, rightly described as a system of female servitude. Of course, wages in respectable positions for women were so low that the only way a woman could gain any real wealth was by marrying a rich man, right? But because of the law of coverture, something that most Americans are now no longer aware of, which granted legal ownership of all property to husbands, even women who married wealthy men owned little or nothing of their own. But women who chose to be bad could live well with no help at all from a man. Prostitutes who rose to the top of the industry to become madams owned more wealth by far than any other women in the United States. In fact, they were among the wealthiest people in the United States. One example is Jessie Hayman, a very prominent madam in San Francisco. In fact, you can still go see her, the building in which her brothel was housed in the Tenderloin District in downtown San Francisco. Her brothel included three fireplaces, a saloon, a champagne cellar, and 15 suites that were filled with imported French furniture. She provided each one of her employees with a wardrobe worth a total of $6,000. This is in early 20th century dollars. I don't know exactly what that translates to, but it's huge. Each wardrobe included a fox fur coat, 4 tailored suits, 8 hats, 2 dress coats, 12 pairs of shoes, 12 pairs of gloves, 7 evening gowns, and 7 negligees. Hayman earned enough money from her business to buy several parcels of extremely valuable land in the city, and then she was so wealthy that after the 1906 earthquake that decimated the city, she and several other madams provided food and clothing to thousands of people who were left homeless. Lou Graham. Does anyone know Lou Graham? Okay. The queen of the lava beds. She was Seattle's most prominent and wealthiest madam. She was also, without a doubt, one of Seattle's wealthiest residents overall. She invested heavily in the stock market and in real estate, and she became one of the largest landholders in the entire Pacific Northwest. Now, I don't want to romanticize prostitution. It was certainly not paradise to be a prostitute. Some madams abused their employees. Some of them placed them in peonage. But those madams tended to be failures. Why? Because of the very tight labor market. To attract women in the very competitive markets, especially in Western boomtowns, where the demand for prostitutes was always intense, most madams not only paid their employees far higher wages than they would find in any other employment, they also typically provided free birth control, free health care, free legal assistance, free housing, and free meals for their employees. Very few Americans of either sex in the 19th century, and even today, enjoyed such benefits. Now, you're probably wondering, well, what did the prostitutes themselves think about this? And we have some answers to that question. And some of the answers might surprise you. In 1859, a very prominent doctor in New York City named William Sanger conducted a poll, a survey of 2,000 women who sold sex. And Sanger went into this expecting them to all say, "I became a prostitute because I was destitute." And he was shocked at what he found. Now, roughly half of the prostitutes he interviewed did give him the answers he was expecting. They gave answers such as, to the question he asked them was, "What was the cause of your becoming a prostitute?" Roughly half of them said things like destitution, seduced and abandoned, or ill treatment of parents, relatives, or husbands, or bad company generally. But to Sanger's great horror and surprise, 513 of the women he interviewed said that they, this is more than one quarter, said that they chose their profession in order to gratify their sexual desires. Sanger said that the women who gave this answer revealed what he called an innate depravity, a want of true womanly feeling, which is actually incredible. And then, this is not the entire, there's even more answers that are more surprising. A large number of the women he interviewed did not even see their profession as being work at all. 181 of them stated as their main reason for choosing it, quote, drink and the desire to drink. 124 of them saw prostitution as, quote, an easy life. And then 29 women, and these might be the baddest renegades in all of American history, said that they became prostitutes because they were, quote, too idle to work. the two leading historians of American prostitution have found similar evidence. Timothy Guilfoyle wrote a very important book on prostitution in 19th century New York City. He said, these women did not view prostitution as deviance or sin. Rather, they considered it a better alternative to the factory or domestic servitude. And Ruth Rosen, who wrote the very first scholarly study of prostitution that was published in 1978, I think it's still the best book on the subject, Rosen said, she was, quote, struck again and again by most prostitutes' view of their work as being easier and less oppressive than other survival strategies they might have chosen. And actually, the chapter on prostitution was excerpted on Alternet for about a week, and hundreds of people wrote in, and dozens of them were former sex or current sex workers. And they argued, you know, if you think that working, they think of exploiting your body in that way, using your body for sex, rather than being exploited to work on a factory or scrubbing floors. If you think selling your body for sex is worse than selling your body for scrubbing floors, that says something about what you think about sex. And I think they might be right. Prostitutes also undermined virtually every sexual taboo that limited the freedom of women. In 1873, the United States Congress passed the Comstock Act, fairly famous, infamous law. The Comstock Act effectively banned the distribution of birth control. It was in effect until the 1920s. But during that time, an underground army of renegades continued to produce, distribute, and purchase illegally contraceptives and keep sexual freedom alive for all of us. And, of course, the steadiest and largest pool of consumers during that time was prostitutes. By the 1870s, it was estimated, or it is estimated by historians, that 5 to 10% of women in American cities, or several million women, were prostitutes in the 1870s. That's a huge market for birth control when it was illegal. These women kept underground birth control businesses alive until the legalization of contraceptives in the 1920s. The largest manufacturer of illegal contraceptives during this period, during those decades, was a man named Julius Schmid. He was a German Jewish immigrant who had a house near Times Square. Of course, Times Square had the red light district. And he had an underground factory in which he employed his wife and his children and other workers making condoms and diaphragms. He produced hundreds of thousands of these things over decades, all underground, all illegally. And he had his factory in the right place. Most of his customers were prostitutes. Prostitutes kept that business alive. When legalization came in the 1920s, Schmid became the producer of the best-selling condoms in the United States. So if you have ever used a 4X, Ramses, or Chic condom, you have an unassimilated Jewish criminal and thousands of whores to thank. Prostitutes were the vanguard of the sexual revolution that broke open the erotic lives of Americans. In the 19th century, oral sex was universally condemned as a sin. During that time, brothels were the only place that a man could receive it without coercion, without rape. Until, in fact, well into the 20th century, medical sexual manuals and marriage advice books that sort of instructed couples how to have sex, they either ignored oral sex altogether or they condemned it as being pathological and perverted. As of 1950, fellatio, even when practiced by a married couple, was a felony in all 48 states. And cunnilingus was a felony in 41 states, which might be an indication of early women's liberation, but I'm not sure. Now, of course, no doubt that many Americans practiced oral sex anyway, but the important point here is that prostitutes were practically the only ones who did so publicly and with no apparent shame. This is just one example. There are many studies that show the same thing. In a 1934 survey of Chicago prostitutes, only 5 solicited what investigators called the normal coitus, while more than 100 offered fellatio. Prostitutes also made dancing part of mainstream American culture. Dance historians have estimated that in the 1910s, more than 100 new dances became fashionable in respectable public places in the U.S. These dances radically overturned Victorian conventions against overt sexuality because they, of course, encouraged couples to dance closely with lots of physical contact and to move their bodies in sensual, really sexual ways. The most influential of these new dances were the Turkey Trot, the Foxtrot, the Charleston, and the Texas Tommy. Historians of dance have cited those dances that became respectable in the 1910s as being the basis for swing dance in the 1930s and 40s, for the movements at the first rock and roll concerts in the 1950s, for disco in the 1970s, and for hip-hop. There's wide agreement on that. Those dances were invented by ex-slaves and their descendants in the South, but then they were popularized among whites by prostitutes in the red light district of San Francisco known as the Barbary Coast. Through the 19th century and into the early 20th, prostitutes were virtually the only women in the United States who wore makeup, who colored their hair, or who wore brightly colored clothing. The red dress was the symbol of the sex trade. It was known as the scarlet shame of streetwalkers. If you wore a red dress in public, you were a prostitute. Respectable women simply never wore a red dress. It was the sure sign of what you did for a living was illicit. But by the early 20th century, as more and more women left the countryside and came into cities and discovered new freedoms there, they made elements of the prostitute styles their own. In the first 3 decades of the 20th century, the number of American perfume and cosmetics manufacturers nearly doubled, and the factory value of their products rose tenfold. At the new dance halls that spread across the cities in the 10s and 20s that became all the rage, the use of rouge, powder, and lipstick was an almost universal custom. A lot of newspapers noted during this time that the wealthiest women in society had also adopted the look of the street. The New York World was somewhat shocked when it reported that, quote, society women now paint their faces, even those in very select circles. And the historian Kathy Pice, who's written the definitive study of the history of cosmetics, said that by the 1910s, it was often difficult to distinguish the dress and style of respectable women from prostitutes at dances. By the middle of the 20th century, the looks that were pioneered by prostitutes were not only respectable, but also completely normal. Massive adoption of their clothing styles began in the 1910s, when, for the very first time, respectable women unabashedly revealed the skin below their necks. Hems became shorter, hosiery was rolled down to reveal parts of the leg, and dresses were deeply cut to expose cleavage. In 1917, the eminently respectable, completely middle-class and bourgeois magazine, The Ladies' Home Journal, advised in its fashion column for women to wear dresses that were sleeveless and semi-transparent. Now, just a few years before then, only a madam would say such a thing. Many observers also noticed that women smoking and drinking in public, which had been the exclusive practice of prostitutes, were becoming fashionable for women of all classes. And then there was the famous short, cropped, sometimes wavy hairstyle that became the fashion statement of the 1920s. That was invented by which group of women? You're supposed to say flappers, and then I say no. There is evidence, in fact, photographic evidence, of prostitutes wearing that style in New Orleans in 1912 and 1913. That style, that flapper style that was actually invented by prostitutes became so common that it was worn by First Lady Lou Henry Hoover in her official portrait and by First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt in her official portrait, both of which still hang in the White House. And then there was the scarlet shame of whores, the red dress. What happened to the red dress? Well, as you probably know, it became the symbol of American female respectability. Flash forward many, many years to 2005. Laura Bush unveiled in that year at the White House in a ceremony the First Lady's Red Dress Collection. It was a charity for heart disease. At the inaugural event, Laura Bush spoke on behalf of her six predecessors, and she said this: Mrs. Reagan's love of the color red is well known. Lady Bird Johnson celebrated her 80th birthday in her red evening gown. Betty Ford's and Rosalind Carter's red dresses were reliable favorites. Barbara Bush wore red to a state dinner, accompanied, of course, by her pearls. Hillary Clinton's red dress set just the right tone on Valentine's Day, and I wore my red dress to the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow. We've all made good use of our red dresses. You may or may not know that Michelle Obama became the first lady to appear on the cover of Glamour magazine last year. Guess what she was wearing? Prostitutes were also the pioneers in this country of racial integration. During the height of Jim Crow, this is the period from the late 19th century to the early 20th century, when on average one black man was lynched per day in the South, countless thousands of other black men had sex with white women with impunity in the brothels of the wild towns of the West. In fact, no place on the planet was more integrated, I am convinced, after 10 years of research on this, than the 19th century Western whorehouse, saloon, or dance hall. A lot of residents and travelers in the West during this time reported on what they called the kaleidoscopic social makeup of saloons and dance halls. They also reported frequently on the high incidence of interracial sex, in particular in brothels. So-called black and tans were very common. Black and tans were brothels in which both white and prostitutes were employed and which catered to both white and black customers. In big Western cities, especially like Denver and San Francisco and L.A., the typical brothel contained not just black and white prostitutes, but also women from China, from Japan, from Mexico, and from all parts of Europe. There were Jewish madams, there were Italian madams, and there were Cherokee madams. Chinese and Mexican madams controlled a large part of the commerce in early San Francisco and early L.A. And then there were many, many wealthy, powerful, and famous madams who had been born into slavery. Now, this is not to suggest at all that prostitutes were committed in any moral way to racial justice, but that, like all good renegades, they were committed to no morality at all. The university researcher conducted a study of prostitutes, and he was particularly interested in the fact that they often crossed the color line when this was not being done outside of their world. And he got very similar answers from white and black prostitutes about why they did this. The white woman he asked said why she had sex with black men for money. She said, "It ain't that I'm so crazy about colored men, but I can make more money here among them." And a black woman said virtually the same thing. She said, "I like to have white trade because they'll pay more, period." You may know about the great migration of African Americans from the South into cities in the North and in the South. In fact, there's a new best-selling book out about this. I'm sure it doesn't mention this part about the great migration. During the great migration, there was another great migration across the sexual color line. In Chicago and New York, police investigators reported frequently on the proliferation of brothels which explicitly and specifically and loudly and unashamedly sold and marketed the violation of America's greatest taboo. A lot of these establishments catered either to black men seeking white prostitutes or to white men seeking black prostitutes. In 1928, this is decades before the Civil Rights Movement began, this is 1 year before Martin Luther King was even born, undercover investigators of brothels in New York City found racial integration nearly everywhere they looked. One of the most thriving establishments of this kind in New York was a place called Spans. It was in Harlem. And it advertised itself in newspapers and on its door as a club of, quote, white women for colored men. Another speakeasy in New York was described by investigators as employing, quote, white women operated for colored men only. And in Chicago, a black-white club was visited by an undercover investigator, and at that club he found 9 white women, 8 of whom were there in the company of black men. Now, just like their counterparts in the Western boomtowns, the proprietors of black-white brothels in the North were pure renegades who cared little for morality. They cared little for social conventions. They cared little for the wishes of the community. One of them put it this way, "We take anybody that has the money." And like all good renegades, I argue in the book, they opened freedoms for countless people. So who were the enemies of these renegades? And who were the enemies of the freedoms that they pioneered? Some of them were the usual suspects. Some of them were the kinds of elite white men you might expect, but others were not. The founding fathers waged a relentless attack on what John Adams called the corruption which is prevalent in so many American hearts, a depravity that is more inconsistent with our Republican governments than light is with darkness. The founders wrote pamphlets after pamphlets, after books after books. They gave speeches after speeches extolling the work ethic. They called for Americans to shun non-marital sex of all kinds. One of the leading industries of the early 19th century was for devices that stopped people from masturbating. There was one of the most commonly used devices of the time, promoted by some of the founding fathers, kept women from opening their legs. The founding fathers, especially John Adams, believed that dancing would destroy the Republic. Adams was very concerned about this. He wrote a lot about it. They told Americans to resist any clothing that made them look fashionable. Benjamin Franklin said that the good American wears simple, homespun, homely clothing. Many great capitalists, you may not be, probably are not surprised to hear, in the 19th century upheld the work ethic, of course, for their workers. Thousands of ministers did so as well, and these groups helped create a formal culture in the United States that many have described as being more repressive than Victorian England. But a lot of the figures now known as the people's heroes, the voice of the oppressed, also attacked renegade freedoms and pleasures. Very, very few Americans are aware that most abolitionists believed that one of slavery's great evils was its promotion of laziness. Abolitionists argued consistently that because slavery denied the incentive to work, it produced not only what one of them called ignorance and stupidity among the slaves, but also, quote, the petty thefts, the necessity of constant watching, and rather than the willful exertion of free labor, reluctant service. Opponents of slavery disagreed over a lot of things. They disagreed over whether to invade the South. They disagreed over whether slaves, blacks, were biologically inferior. But they all agreed that the institution of slavery made people less industrious. Abolitionists produced statistics, reams of statistics, showing that slave labor was less productive than free labor, and they publicized their observations that slaves did not hold the work ethic. James Thome was a very well-known abolitionist in the 19th century. He was also one of the few who lived on a plantation, one of the few who had experience with slaves directly. And he said this about slave culture, and this was very similar to what other abolitionists were saying. He said, "Slaves roam over the village streets, shocking the ear with their vulgar jestings and voluptuous songs. They pass the evening in gambling, dancing, drinking, and the most obscene conversation, kept up until the night is far spent. Then they crown the scene with an indiscriminate debauchery." According to Thome and many abolitionists, slaves were having way too much fun. And according to them, this terrible freedom, this terrible love of life over work, was caused by the exclusion of slaves from the culture of self-restraint. And I think they were exactly right about that. Slaves had not been taught to love work. They had not been taught to be American. a major argument for going to war against the South was to make the region and its slaves less licentious and more productive. Now, just like the abolitionists, early American feminists are often thought of as being proponents of freedom. But feminists in the 19th century, unfortunately, did a lot to punish the renegade women of the time and to squash the freedoms that they created through what was called, and this sort of says it all, the social purity movement. Organizations such as the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the National Purity Association became training grounds for the suffrage movement, and they were enormously powerful lobbying groups between the 1870s and World War I. Ruth Rosen, the historian I cited earlier, put it this way. She said, feminism and social purity were very much intertwined, with members of each movement supporting causes of the other. Social purity activists formed vice commissions in nearly every city in the United States, and their stated goal was what they called the absolute annihilation of prostitution. They carried ominous names like the New England Watch and Ward Society, the New York Committee of 14, and my favorite, the Los Angeles Morals Efficiency Committee. In the first two decades of the 20th century, the vice commissions that were led by feminists successfully lobbied police and courts to radically increase prosecution of prostitution. In response to their lobbying, several states built reformatories specifically for prostitutes in which women were trained to sew and clean and cook, to be wives and mothers. Most states during this period passed laws that allowed courts to shut down brothels entirely, board them up, and kick the inhabitants onto the streets. So suddenly, prostitutes were left without the protection of a madam, and most madams before then owned and used guns, and most madams during that time employed police officers to protect their employees. They no longer had that protection. They no longer had the protection of the four walls of the brothels. They were left to deal with hostile cops and sadistic customers all by themselves. So they had nowhere to turn but where? To male criminals. This is when pimps began to dominate the practice of prostitution. So by attempting to banish the sex trade, feminists simply moved it from female power to male power. Feminists, unfortunately, also contributed greatly to the growing theory, now known as eugenics, that sinful behavior, such as prostitution, was genetically determined. 12 states passed laws that allowed judges to order the forced sterilization of criminals and people who were classified as perverts, idiots, or feeble-minded. Prostitutes were generally thought to belong to all four categories. And so, in the first half of the 20th century, some 40,000 women were forcibly sterilized for selling sex. So, why did those people who spoke on behalf of the people, the voice of the oppressed, work so hard to vanquish the freedoms that so many of us now cherish? And the answer, I believe, can be found by looking at American history in a new way, and that's what I try to do in this book. The story of this country is not just one of struggles between rich and poor, between white and black, between men and women, although I think those struggles are all central and important. American history was also driven by clashes between those interested in preserving community and those who were more interested in pursuing simply their own desires. This was the fight between the respectable and the degenerate, the moral and the immoral, between good citizens and bad citizens. This is the story of American civilization and its discontents. So on one side of the struggle, I put together a lot of groups you don't normally think of as being linked. People like the Founding Fathers and abolitionists and great capitalists and feminists. Later in the book, I link to them as well. Civil rights leaders and trade union leaders. What links them all together? All of those groups either held or sought social power, which meant that they also sought social control. And therefore, they worked very hard to limit the personal liberties of their constituents. So there's always been a conflict between these power-seeking moral reformers on the one hand and the lowbrow, unseemly culture of the streets. But I want to make one thing very clear. I'm not a nihilist. I am not advocating a renegade revolution. That would be no place I would want to live in. So the argument in the book, the argument here, is not that bad people, so-called bad people, should replace the disciplinarians, but that in American history, the struggles between the two have determined the breadth of personal liberty. I don't make any claims for other parts of the world. I haven't really studied in any serious way other parts of the world, but I am convinced, after years of research, that in this country, the more that bad people existed, resisted, and won, the more freedom was expanded for everyone. So what I want to say is, let the struggle between the civilizers and renegades of American society be eternal. Let it go on forever. But what I want to do is to make you see how the lowly, degenerate scum of the earth have made this place we live in look anything at all like the land of the free. Thanks very much for coming.
Your final message that at the end of your speaking, you said the struggle is necessary, and about these more corrupt classes are enabling freedoms. And I can think of one example, like the serious consideration of legalization of marijuana.
Great example. Yeah. Yeah, well, so I have a lot to say about that because I live in California, and so we have the initiative coming up in November to legalize marijuana. It is actually the way that the proponents of the initiative frame it, talk about it, is almost puritanical. It's almost as if Cotton Mather were advocating marijuana use. Never once will you hear this said. We would like marijuana to be legal because we like to smoke it. Because it feels good to be high. Period. You will never hear that. Just like you will never hear from abortion, from pro-choice activists, we would like to have sex and not worry about getting pregnant. Period. Never is that the way they argue for it, right? It's always about rights and about the woman's autonomy, blah, blah, blah. If you read Roe v. Wade, there is no mention at all of sexual desire and the wish to, you know, act on it without consequences, right? So they know. So the advocates of the initiative in California to legalize marijuana, you know, they frame it as this human right. It's about personal autonomy, privacy, blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, they're going to regulate it and educate it. That's part of the bill, actually, is to enact education about marijuana and its proper uses in the schools, I guess, or in public education campaigns, I don't know. But there is no mention ever of pleasure in any of that. So in that movement, in those two movements, you actually see this tension inside the same movement, inside the same people. And so what I'm really arguing is not that there's, although sometimes it sounds like it, that there's these wild renegades over here, hedonists, and that there's these uptight, repressed Puritans over here, and that there's a fight between them. Usually it's actually the fight goes on inside of you and inside of me, inside of individuals, and we constantly struggle with this. It's the fight, it's the classic fight identified by political philosophers since Plato between the individual and the community. Right, and so we're constantly, each of us has to do that all the time.
Community,
yeah. Individuality with impunity is those are the heroes, yeah, of the book. I'm looking at American culture through this new prism, right? And you can actually see that fight. That cultural fight playing out in those movements. Yes, again.
Sort of to follow up, the media is kind of helping the struggle go on now with the internet and watching more voices and whatnot. Do you think it's helped this struggle, or maybe successful just because of that pollution?
So now I'm going to get a little bit academic, but I'll try to still make it entertaining. Daniel Bell is a great sociologist who wrote an essay, which was also a book in the early 70s, called The Cultural Contradiction of Capitalism, in which he said that capitalism produces these two opposing forces. Very fascinating. On the one hand, capitalists make you work. You must be disciplined. You must repress your desires to go sit in a cubicle and type at a computer all day, or to work in a factory, or to do anything, right? It requires repression. So we call that Puritanism. right? The Puritanism that capitalism produces. Then he said, at the very same time, capitalism is producing hedonism, because it must appeal to your base, unseemly, primitive desires, your individual desires. And these two forces are always clashing. And so you will see this. Go turn on the TV right now and watch it for 5 minutes, and I promise you, in that five-minute span, you will see both Puritanism and hedonism expressed. You will see Britney Spears, and you will hear Barack Obama talk about how we should all be workers and fathers and mothers and citizens and soldiers and die for our country. And that's constantly played out. And watch a sporting event. I've never watched a sporting event in which an announcer did not talk about the work ethic of one of the athletes, right? It's usually the one white guy on the basketball team. But even when it's all whites or all blacks, there's going to be one or two guys who has a great work ethic. I have never watched a game in which I haven't heard that. So you hear it back and forth, right? But also sports is leisure and fun and individual non-productive stuff, right? So that's capitalism, sort of fighting itself in this really interesting way. And that's really the fight that I identify. In the back, and then, yes.
Talk about the repudiation of debt by the low-income people and the moratorium on foreclosures and stuff like that. Is that another...
Oh, totally. I was actually going to write about that, yeah. People walking away from their houses or staying in their houses. Now that that's what's happening, it's fantastic. I think it's a wonderful movement. And there's an argument made, I was going to make it, but then it was stolen by some professor in Arizona, to just tell people, just stay there. Or just walk away from the thing, right? Because when everyone does it, like what's been happening, it becomes a cultural norm, just like those shiftless workers in the 19th century. What can the bosses now do when everyone's doing it, right? And so what people were doing was they were taking money, they would get second mortgages, and a lot of them were then going on vacation to the Bahamas with that money, right? And now, what are they going to do? What's B of A going to do to those people? How are you going to take the Bahamas vacation back from them? Right? It's gone. Sorry. So it's this wonderful movement. And now you have, and I've heard studies of this, and I've even heard it on NPR, hundreds of thousands, I guess, people, possibly millions, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of people sitting in their houses, and they've been sitting in their houses for years now, one or 2 years, without paying a dime to anyone. And the bank isn't even knocking on the door because they have so many to deal with. They can't bother. They can't do it anymore. It's become a cultural movement, which, as I was arguing, is much more powerful than any law, so, or any organized movement in a way. But anyway, thanks very much for coming.